Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Just moments ago, on the House floor, we passed by overwhelming numbers the ability to keep government open for the next 6 weeks.
The House and Senate voted Saturday to keep funding the federal government for 45 days, but the House is in a state of turmoil as far-right lawmakers threaten to oust House Speaker Kevin McCarthy for working with Democrats to pass the spending bill. We'll get the latest from Capitol Hill and look at the legacy of California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who died at the age of 90 last week. She was the longest-serving woman to ever serve in the Senate. Then, October is National Domestic Violence Awareness and Prevention Month. We'll look at the remarkable story of a domestic violence survivor, Tracy McCarter. She's a nurse and grandmother who was jailed after her husband died of a stab wound when she defended herself during an altercation. Her imprisonment sparked outrage across the country.
I stand with Tracy.
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 I stand with my mom.
Today, Tracy McCarter joins us for her first television interview since her murder charge was dismissed almost a year ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Congress narrowly averted a government shutdown Saturday just hours before a midnight deadline in an unexpected reversal. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy agreed to a plan with Democrats and a majority of Republicans to keep the government running until November 17th. The bill does not include aid for Ukraine, but it does earmark $16 billion for disaster relief funds. The measure quickly passed through the Senate and was signed by President Biden late Saturday. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries claimed the victory for the American people after the bill's passage, saying it followed a, quote, complete and total surrender by right-wing extremists, unquote. Biden castigated Republicans for once again manufacturing a crisis over funding the government.
The brinkmanship has to end. And there should be another, there shouldn't be another crisis. There's no excuse for another crisis. Consequently, I strongly urge my Republican friends in Congress not to wait. Don't waste time as you did all summer. Pass a year-long budget agreement. Honor the deal we made a few months ago.
Florida right-wing Congressmember Matt Gaetz said Sunday he will move to oust McCarthy as House Speaker following passage of the Democrat-backed bill. Far-right Republicans had demanded steep spending cuts and funds to further militarize the southern border. Meanwhile, New York progressive Congressmember Jamal Bowman has apologized after he pulled a fire alarm as House Democrats considered McCarthy's bill before a rush vote on the stopgap measure. Bowman said he thought pulling the alarm would open a door and that he was not trying to delay the vote. House Republicans and the Capitol Police have launched investigations into the incident. California Governor Gavin Newsom has tapped LaFonza Butler to fill the Senate seat of Dianne Feinstein after her death Thursday. Butler is a former labor leader at the Service Employees International Union and current president of Emily's List, which helps elect pro-abortion Democratic women to public office. LaFonza Butler would be the first openly gay U.S. senator representing California and fulfills Newsom's pledge to appoint a black woman to the post. But despite her union background, Butler more recently advised Uber as it fought the California law requiring app companies to grant workers employee benefits. Newsom had ruled out naming a current U.S. Senate candidate for the seat, including progressive hopeful Barbara Lee, though LaFonza Butler could decide to join the race as interim senator. The body of late Senator Dianne Feinstein was flown back to California Saturday. She'll lie in state at San Francisco City Hall Wednesday ahead of funeral services Thursday. Tributes continued to pour in for Feinstein over the weekend. Raised in an abusive home, she went on to become the first woman mayor of San Francisco. She was a pioneering figure in U.S. politics, as well as the first woman to lead the Senate Judiciary and Intelligence Committee. She spearheaded the 1994 bill banning semi-automatic firearms. Feinstein remained to the right of the Democratic Party from her time as a law and order mayor of San Francisco through her support of U.S. wars and invasions, including in Iraq and Afghanistan. In 1982, she killed a bill that would have allowed domestic partner benefits for same-sex public employees in San Francisco. Former U.N. weapons inspector Scott Ritter said on X this weekend he briefed Feinstein on the lack of evidence that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Yet she went on, like most of the Democratic Party, to back George W. Bush's illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. Ritter added, quote, "The blood of thousands of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis stains her soul," he said. In 2014, Dianne Feinstein insisted on releasing a report on the CIA's detention and interrogation torture program following 9/11, calling the CIA's practices a stain on our values and on our history, unquote. More recently, Feinstein drew ire after she condescended to children in her district who came to her office asking her to sign on to the Green New Deal. She chided the young activist, telling one 16-year-old, "You didn't vote for me." New York Governor Kathy Hochul declared a state of emergency Friday as torrential rains brought flash flooding to the Hudson Valley, Long Island, and New York City streets. The deluge turned highways into raging rivers and brought half of New York's subway system to a halt. More than 8 inches of rain fell on JFK Airport in just 24 hours, an all-time precipitation record that Governor Hochul blamed on the climate crisis.
And, of course, we know this is a result of climate change. This is, unfortunately, what we have to expect as the new normal. It makes us be more prepared than ever before. And it requires us to focus on resiliency, to head off the horrific impacts that could be there if we're not ready for the next storm.
Meanwhile, New York is under another air quality alert today, triggered by smoke from record-shattering wildfires in Canada. In labor news, United Auto Workers ramped up their strike Friday as Union President Sean Fain called on 7,000 more workers at a Ford and a General Motors plant to walk off the job.
We're still talking with all three companies, and I'm still very hopeful that we can reach a deal that reflects the incredible sacrifices and contributions our members have made over the last decade. But I also know that what we win at the bargaining table depends on the power we build on the job. It's time to use that power.
It's the second escalation since the strike against Ford, GM, and Stellantis began 2 weeks ago. Amid skyrocketing CEO compensation, workers are asking for a 40% raise, better benefits, and an end to tiered wages. Separately, some 4,000 UAW members who work for Volvo's Mack Trucks plants in Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Florida agreed to a tentative deal staving off a possible strike there. Meanwhile, 75,000 healthcare workers for Kaiser Permanente could go on strike from Wednesday through the end of the week. After their contract expired over the weekend, talks have failed to yield a new agreement as workers seek higher pay, better staffing, and improvements in their pension plans and other benefits. The strike would affect Kaiser workers in California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. In Mexico, two Mexican migrants were killed Friday in a shooting near the border city of Tecate in Baja California State. Three others were wounded. The group of 14 migrants were crossing the Cochuma Hill in the middle of the desert, a site that's sacred to local indigenous communities and a common route used by drug traffickers and human smugglers. Mexican officials said the cause of the shooting is not known. Harsh border policies have forced migrants heading to the U.S. border to rely on smugglers and crossing through remote and dangerous areas where they're vulnerable to extortion and violence from Mexican law enforcement and drug groups. In related news, at least 10 Cuban migrants were killed and over a dozen others injured Sunday after the freight truck they were riding in crashed on a highway in the state of Chiapas near the border with Guatemala. Another migrant from Ecuador also died in a crash in the city of Mexicali across the border from Calexico, California, after being taken into custody by Mexican immigration officials whose van hit a bus and then a utility pole. At least 10 other migrants from Guatemala and Colombia were also wounded in Saturday's accident. In Slovakia, former Prime Minister Robert Fico emerged as the leading candidate to head a coalition government after his Russia-friendly party won the largest share of votes in Sunday's parliamentary election. He's called for negotiations to end Russia's war in Ukraine and campaigned on a pledge to halt arms shipments from Slovakia to Kyiv. He previously said allowing Ukraine to join NATO would mean the beginning of World War III. On Sunday, Fico said a top priority of the new government should be to crack down on asylum seekers and migrants crossing Slovakia's border with Hungary.
One of the government's first decisions must be a government regulation to restore border controls with Hungary. And yes, that's all there is to it, and I stand by it. It won't be pretty pictures. Force may be needed to solve the migrant problem.
The Liberal Progressive Slovakia Party, which came in second and supports arming Ukraine, said it'll try to form a coalition government to prevent Fico from taking power. In Spain, right-wing opposition leader Alberto Núñez Feijóo has failed in his bid to form a new government, clearing the way for acting Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez to win four more years in power. In order to clinch another term, Sánchez will need to win the support of two Catalan parties who are demanding amnesty for hundreds of Catalan separatist activists arrested during mass protests in 2017. This is a pro-independent student activist in Barcelona.
He wants to respect the Catalan nation. He has to do some steps to go for the amnesty and for the self-determination. So he has to choose if he wants to put Spain back to the right and extreme right parties in the power, or he wants to progress and go for the future and respect the Catalan people.
Voters in the Maldives have elected opposition leader Mohamed Muizu as president of the Indian Ocean Archipelago. He won 54% of the vote in Sunday's runoff election, defeating the incumbent president, Ibrahim Mohamed Soleh, who cultivated strategic ties with India. Mohamed Muizu oversaw several Chinese-funded infrastructure projects in the Maldives and is more closely aligned with Beijing. In California, protesters gathered in the city of San Pablo Saturday to condemn the proposed construction of a $43 million police training center and shooting range. The city northeast of San Francisco has already fenced off a massive piece of land where the complex will stand, directly across the street from the San Pablo City Hall. Protesters invoked the Fight to Stop Cop City in Atlanta, where dozens have been charged with domestic terrorism over their opposition to that site. This is a San Pablo demonstrator speaking anonymously for safety.
It's no wonder that after 2020 and the most massive sort of upsurge of anti-police antagonism in the United States, that the proposed plans for police training facilities are popping up all over the country, right? So they want to better prepare basically for counterinsurgency, to better prepare to police and murder black and brown communities and people who seek to establish their freedom.
Donald Trump arrived in New York City Sunday night ahead of his appearance in court today for the start of his civil fraud trial. A judge last week agreed with New York Attorney General Letitia James that Trump, his two sons, and the Trump Organization unlawfully inflated the value of their assets to obtain favorable loans and lower insurance rates. James is seeking $250 million in damages and a ban on Trump doing business in New York. Meanwhile, in Georgia, Scott Hall, one of Trump's co-defendants in his election interference case, pleaded guilty to five criminal counts related to efforts to remove and tamper with election equipment. Hall, a Georgia bond bailsman, is the first co-conspirator to plead guilty. As part of a deal with Fulton County prosecutors, he's agreed to testify in future proceedings and receive 5 years probation along with a fine of $5,000. And the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine has been jointly awarded to doctors Catalin Carrico and Drew Weissman, whose work led to the development of the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines. That technology is now being used in research for other illnesses, including cancer. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, the House and Senate vote to keep funding the federal government, but the House is in a state of turmoil as far-right lawmakers threaten to oust the House Speaker. We'll get the latest and look at the legacy of California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's died at the age of 90. Stay with us. As long as You Follow by Fleetwood Mac. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House and Senate voted Saturday night to keep funding the federal government for 45 days, but the House is in a state of turmoil as far-right lawmakers threaten to oust House Speaker Kevin McCarthy for working with Democrats to pass the spending bill, which averted a government shutdown. The final vote in the House on the stopgap spending measure was 335-91. All but one Democrat supported the measure, which was opposed by 90 Republicans. The bill did not include any aid for Ukraine. The Senate had previously approved about $6 billion in new aid for Ukraine, but that was stripped from the final bill. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy spoke to reporters Saturday night.
Would I have wanted the bill we put on the floor yesterday that would secure our border, cut wasteful spending? Yes, I did. But I had some members in our own conference that wouldn't vote for that. So if you have members in your conference that won't let you vote for appropriation bills, doesn't want an omnibus, and won't vote for a stopgap measure, so the only answer is to shut down and not pay our troops, I don't want to be a part of that team. I want to be a part of a conservative group that wants to get things done.
Less than 24 hours after the House passed the spending bill, Republican Congressmember Matt Gaetz of the House Freedom Caucus told CNN he would introduce a motion to remove McCarthy as Speaker for working with Democrats.
I do intend to file a motion to vacate against Speaker McCarthy this week. I think we need to rip off the Band-Aid. I think we need to move on with new leadership that can be trustworthy. Look, the one thing everybody has in common is that nobody trusts Kevin McCarthy. He lied to Biden. He lied to House conservatives. He had appropriators marking to a different number altogether. And the reason we were backed up against the shutdown politics is not a bug of the system. It's a feature.
The drama over a possible government shutdown was just one of the major stories on Capitol Hill over the weekend. On Thursday night, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein died at the age of 90, the longest-serving woman ever to serve in the Senate. On Sunday, California Governor Gavin Newsom tapped LaFonza Butler to temporarily fill the seat. Butler's the president of Emily's List. She served as an advisor to Vice President Kamala Harris's 2020 presidential campaign. She's a former leader of the union SEIU in California for the home health care workers. But more recently, she advised Uber as it fought the California law requiring app companies to grant workers employee benefits. Butler will become the only black woman in the Senate and California's first openly LGBTQ plus senator. The Congressional Black Caucus had urged Newsom to pick Congressmember Barbara Lee, who's already running for Feinstein's seat. Katie Porter and Adam Schiff are also running for the Senate seat. To talk about all of this and more, we go now to California, where we're joined by Sasha Abramski. He's the West Coast correspondent for The Nation. His new piece for The Nation is Dianne Feinstein's Empty Seat. His recent piece for Truthout is a small cadre of GOP hardliners is pushing U.S. toward government shutdown, which, Sasha, in fact, did not happen. So can you talk about first the drama on Saturday night? And what's going to happen to House Speaker McCarthy?
Yeah, good morning, Amy. It's good to be on. What happened Saturday night was an entirely predictable consequence of what McCarthy did in order to become Speaker last year. Basically, it took 15 votes to become Speaker. And to get there, he had to make all kinds of promises to empower the far right of his caucus, people like Matt Gaetz, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, and so on. It was entirely predictable that if you gave power to bomb throwers, that they would throw bombs. And sure enough, they did. What they tried to do was shut down the basic functioning of government. You played a clip of McCarthy saying, well, I've got a part of my caucus who just won't vote for omnibus spending bills. Well, if you're running in government, you're in Congress, and you refuse your basic obligation to pass omnibus spending bills to keep government open, you're responsible if at the end of the day the TSA aren't paid, the military aren't paid, if Head Start programs start to shut down, if WIC can't pay its recipients, if the SNAP program can't pay its recipients, if people going on holidays to national parks find that the parks are shuttered. And McCarthy realized that. He realized that if he let the government shut down, the Republicans would be blamed fully and squarely for the consequences. McCarthy is nothing if not an opportunist. What McCarthy wants is political power. And so at the end of the day, McCarthy cut a deal with Democrats to keep government open. Now, again, it's entirely predictable, given the fact that he ceded the right, the power to challenge him if a single member of Congress wanted to challenge him. It's entirely predictable that within minutes of that compromise, Matt Gaetz had thrown another bomb and said, look, I'm going to be challenging you. I'm going to be making a motion to vacate the speakership. And that's the drama that's going to be playing out this week in Washington, D.C. It's a crisis entirely of Kevin McCarthy's own making.
So you have the far right Congressmember Matt Gaetz challenging him as speaker, but the Congressional Progressive Caucus will not back him either.
There's absolutely no reason that the Democrats of any stripe, progressive or mainstream or however you want to define them, there is no reason the Democrats should bail McCarthy out. Look, McCarthy launched an entirely spurious impeachment inquiry investigation into President Biden. It was a fishing expedition. There was no evidence there. There was no smoking gun. There was just this hunch that McCarthy had that things weren't quite right, and therefore he launched an impeachment inquiry. Well, if that's McCarthy's strategy, why on earth would the Democrats not sit back and watch him squirm? And I suspect that's exactly what they're going to do this week. If they want McCarthy to bail him out, at the bare minimum, they're going to be asking him to put a halt on the impeachment inquiry.
And of course, that impeachment inquiry hearing that took place on Thursday, the Republicans' own witnesses said there wasn't enough information, like a lawyer, like Attorney Turley.
It was sort of joyous to watch. It was amateurville. I mean, this was not politics of a high caliber. This was the most ill-prepared, ill-thought-out, poorly advised Republican inquiry you could possibly imagine. You contrast it with the meticulousness of the investigations and the hearings into Donald Trump for what he did around Ukraine, for what he did after January 6th. You contrast it with the January 6th committee hearings, the bipartisan hearings where Liz Cheney went out and said, look, here's why this is so dangerous to democracy. That was meticulously prepared. What the Republicans did the other day, it was a partisan show. It had no merit, and it was entirely amateur.
And then you have the issue of the funding of Ukraine, which is not included in this bill, though the Senate had voted for $6 billion. Michael Bennet, the senator from Colorado, almost scuttled the deal. And then you have that one lone Democrat who voted against the deal in the House, Quigley from Chicago, also based on the stripping of funding for Ukraine, Sasha.
That's right. Quigley is the chair, I believe, of the Ukrainian caucus in Congress, and he was absolutely furious that that funding had been stripped. What I find so fascinating about this is the absolute volte-face that the Republican Party has done on foreign policy and on national security since the beginning of the Trump years. If you'd gone back 10, 15 years, the Republican Party were the party, self-proclaimed party of, you know, everything military, everything national security. You fast forward now and they're an isolationist party, or at least one wing is isolationist. More than isolationist, they're a pro-Putin party. You know, it's one thing to say, look, we don't want to be involved in wars. It's one thing to say we've got to have a debate about the size of the American military. That's fine. But it's completely extraordinary that a significant wing of the Republican Party is throwing in their lot with Vladimir Putin. It's also entirely predictable because during his presidency, time and again, Trump threw his lot in with Vladimir Putin. Well, if you're going to throw your lot in with somebody who's dictatorial, if you're going to throw your lot in with somebody who has done everything he can to undermine democratic systems, not just in the United States, but across the Western world, if that is your bedfellow, you're going to come to strange policy conclusions. And that's what we saw in this debate, that the only way Congress could pass an omnibus spending bill and keep American government open was ceding to the far right on the issue of Ukraine. Completely extraordinary to watch. And I have, can only think it's going to result in all kinds of internal debates within the Republican Party, because there are people out there, people like Nikki Haley, people like Mike Pence, who in public are perfectly willing to say that strategy is crazy. It doesn't make sense to appease Vladimir Putin. And they are saying it in public. And I think over the next few months, as we get closer and closer to the primary season, that debate is going to become ever more public and ever more acrimonious.
Sasha Bromski, if you can talk about this latest news last night, California Governor Gavin Newsom tapping LaFonza Butler to fill the Senate seat of Dianne Feinstein. The significance of this interim appointment.
I think it's an extraordinarily smart move of Gavin Newsom's. He put himself into a bit of a bind in 2021. He made a pledge that he would appoint, if he had the opportunity to appoint, an African-American female to the Senate. Now, the problem that he then encountered was, in the interim, Barbara Lee, Katie Porter, Adam Schiff had all thrown their hat into the ring for the primary season in early 2024. That was after Dianne Feinstein had announced that she wasn't going to run for re-election in 2024. Well, Newsom didn't want to tip the scales there, and I think he was very wise not to do so. You have an open primary, you have three extremely credible candidates, all three of which have very, very strong congressional records, and all three of which have put in a tremendous amount of effort to build up their political infrastructure in the run-up to those primaries. So Newsom didn't want to tip the scales, and Barbara Lee was lobbying very, very hard to be announced as the interim senator. And I think quite rightly, Newsom said, you know what, I'm going to step back out of this fight. And so he turned to somebody who wasn't an elected official. He turned to the Emily's List president, LaFonza Butler. And she has a strong track record. She's got a strong record as a Labour leader. She's got an extremely strong record as the president of Emily's List. She's defending LGBTQ rights. She's defending abortion rights. She's a very, very credible senator. And she obviously struck a good deal with Newsom, because what he didn't extract from her was a promise not to run in 2024. So she's a caretaker senator, but if she wants to throw her hat in the ring and file paperwork by December 8th, she can throw her hat in the ring and become the fourth candidate for the open seat. I think it's going to be a fascinating political time. I'm really, really glad that he appointed somebody so quickly. I think it could have been a very drawn-out process. The Democrats don't have a big enough majority in Congress and the Senate for that to be a safe move. I think it was a far smarter move to do this quickly, to put somebody in power in the Senate, and to move on, because now it means that the Democrats again have a workable majority in the Senate and they can start passing more legislation. I think he did something very sensible yesterday.
Isn't this a slap in the face to Barbara Lee? Because his reasoning was that he didn't want to tip the race, as you pointed out, with these three strong candidates. But unlike when McCain died and Senator Kyle came back, truly interim, was not running, he has now introduced a fourth person who could be a candidate, right? LaFonza Butler. And of course, he had gone back on his word to appoint an African-American woman to the Senate after Kamala Harris became the vice president. So he was going to do it. The question was, I mean, as late as Sunday, the Congressional Black Caucus sent him a letter saying he should appoint Barbara Lee, who would fill out the term and then run with the others.
Yeah, I mean, Barbara Lee is clearly extremely unhappy by this. And, you know, to a degree, she's a little bit unlucky by the process, the way it's unfolded, the timing of Dianne Feinstein's death and so on. But if you look at the polling, Katie Porter and Adam Schiff are pretty far ahead in the polling, and Barbara Lee's a distant third. If you look at the fundraising, the same thing holds. Katie Porter and Adam Schiff have built up these large political war chests, and Barbara Lee is far behind in the fundraising. Now, that's not because her politics aren't good. It's not because she doesn't have, you know, a very noble history in Congress. I think at least in part it's because Californians are looking for a generational change. Dianne Feinstein was 90 years old. She was the longest-serving female U.S. senator. Dianne Feinstein had a very, very strong, very important history. You talked about it in your program earlier. But she was 90 years old, and she should have retired years ago. If you're looking for a generational change, it's very hard to justify how you get that generational change when you shift from a 90-year-old to a 77-year-old, which is how old Barbara Lee is, I believe. It's much easier to see that you get a generational change if you shift to somebody who's in their 50s or maybe 60s and who's got a realistic chance of serving in the Senate for two, three, maybe even four terms. Now, LaFonza Butler fits that. She's in her 50s. She's young. She's dynamic. She could, if she makes a good effort at it, be there for a long time. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, look, we need to have an open competition to see who the next senator is going to be.